actually the first person from my country who ever graduated from Stanford GSB with an MBA. So
wow.
Expertise comes with a price. And naivete comes with this benefit of, I don't know anything. So, you know, maybe this should work. This should work. Fundamental idea of how work is done is changing. The future is going to be where AI-led experience will be the first default experience. And human experience will be a premium experience.
Welcome to Artificial Insights, the podcast where we learn to build AI businesses by interviewing product leaders and innovators in AI. I'm your host, Daniel Maneri, and today I'm joined by Chinggis Jumanajorov. He's the CEO and founder of Codif, a company that augments customer support teams with teams of AI agents. He's one of the clearest thinking people that I've talked to on this subject of how AI will change support, but also human interactions. He's also the first person from his home country of Kyrgyzstan to earn a Stanford MBA. And he's done all of this, including founding companies, without a technical background. I think you're going to have a great time hearing what he has to say. Chinggis, could you tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Yeah, thanks, Daniel. So I'm Chinggis. Right now, I'm the founder and CEO at Codif AI. We're building agentic AI for complex customer support automation. And my background, so I'm from Kyrgyzstan originally. I moved to the States back in 2014. And the reason why I came to the US, because I won a green card lottery. And that's how I end up in the US. And before my move to the US, I was in private equity and venture capital space. So I spent a lot of time in Southeast Asia, Central Asia, investing in healthcare, education industries. And when I moved to the States, I want to start a company, and I did. I started a logistics supply chain company in New Jersey, in which I scaled to, you know, $10 million in revenue. It was pretty successful venture, and I sold it, and then I decided, okay, what's next? And I decided to go to Stanford Business School. I decided to continue my education. That's how I ended up in Silicon Valley. And I was fascinated, you know, by what's going on here. I had classes where, you know, Eric Schmidt would teach a class, you know, like the legendary Eric Schmidt who built Google, like legendary Reid Hoffman would teach a class. And I was just fascinated. I was like, this was a whole new world for me, you know, and for a kid from Kyrgyzstan. And fun fact about me is that I'm actually the first person from my country who ever graduated from Stanford GSB with an MBA. So,
wow.
Yeah. It's just a small country, right? It's like small country. And I was so fortunate to be here. And I just was like fascinated by what's going on. And it's a new world. And because I was always entrepreneurial, and my mom was an entrepreneur, you know, and I always tell this because she inspired me to become an entrepreneur as well. But her entrepreneurial journey was different because she was born, you know, in 1960s, and she was like 20 something when Soviet Union collapsed. So she had to start entrepreneurship because of necessity. And I always tell this because I started entrepreneurship not because of necessity, because of opportunity. These are like two different entrepreneurial journeys. And in my opinion, I'm so fortunate, and I always say this, that I kind of, you know, stand on the shoulders of giants, and my mom is the biggest giant in my life. So she was a big inspiration. And so that's how I kind of, you know, knew that I want to start a company. And here I am, like, I'm like, you know, in my like late 20s, I'm in Silicon Valley, a kid from Kyrgyzstan who wants to start a company. I realized that I need to find a technical co-founder because I'm not technical. I can do business stuff, I can sell, and I can market stuff, but I'm not technical. And that's when I started looking for, you know, a technical co-founder. And I was fortunate to meet my co-founder, Norm, who was at Uber, the super smart guy from Kyrgyzstan as well, you know. And he was at Uber, and he was at Uber building this platform called Policy Engine, which is behind all this customer support automation stuff. So if you use Uber, just click the help section in the app. Everything you see there is powered by this platform. And Norm was actually the first engineer who started working on it. Huge impact. Like, led to 150 million requests automated every month, huge scale. And I was like, hey, an entrepreneur in me, I was like, Norm, we should start a company and bring these experiences to companies which don't have this army of engineers, which Uber has. So that was basically the pitch I gave him. And he was like, he was also very entrepreneurial. And we decided to start Codif. And yeah, I guess that's kind of a quick background on me and what we're working on.
Wow. There's a lot to dig in there, especially that standing on the shoulders of what your mom did. That's amazing. But there's a question I like to ask that I think is on everyone's minds with a podcast like this, which is, Chinggis, are you an AI?
No, I am not. Not yet, at least.
Well, that's good to hear. I have had someone say that they were being turned into an AI for a course because they were going to turn themselves into an assistant. So let us know when that happens.
Yeah, I'll keep you posted.
And I'm very curious to know, what do you think is that big difference between entrepreneurship from necessity versus opportunity?
Yeah, I guess, you know, I just compare like, you know, my journey with my mom's journey. So my mom's journey was like, she just didn't have an option, you know? And I feel like this entrepreneurship out of necessity is more maybe even like powerful. Like it's just you like unstoppable because you have kids to feed, you know, like at home who are hungry. And you're like, my mom was like 25 when she started her first venture. She started like going to other countries, basically importing goods because Soviet Union collapsed. And basically there were moments where like people were unemployed. There was no bread on the table. Basically we had those times. And whenever I think you have this moment in life, I think you're just so relentless. Like you just cannot accept no from someone, I feel like. Whenever you're, I think in my opinion, like whenever you're entrepreneur out of necessity, you just, you're unstoppable. I feel like you just go all in because you have your kids back at home. When it's entrepreneurship out of opportunity, I think you can, and in the first phase, you know, probably like the upside is that you're actually like unstoppable, relentless. On the downside is like, you're just thinking about this next move. You're not like taking a big picture, like, okay, you know, what's going on in the world? Like how we can like build a big business. And my mom, she never thought about building a big business. She was just thinking about like building a business to make ends meet and to feed her family. And in my case, I think I was like fortunate because I could land a good job, you know, in Silicon Valley. But then for me, it was like, the reason why I decided to take this, you know, entrepreneurial journey in Silicon Valley, because I felt this, right? So I'm here, you know, from Kyrgyzstan. My whole family is back home. Like my parents, my sisters, my brothers, my nephews, the whole extended family is back in Kyrgyzstan. And it's very far. It's, you know, in order to get to Kyrgyzstan, you need to spend 24 hours, actually.
Ooh.
And then so imagine I'm here, right? And I'm like building my life here. The question I ask myself, I'm paying a very high price, you know, to be here. What I mean by that is I'm not seeing my parents getting old. I'm not seeing my brothers getting, you know, all this experiencing this like life events. And I'm not seeing my nephews and nieces growing up. So I'm paying a high price to be here. And I'm like, if I'm paying this high price, then I should take like the biggest upside possibility journey. And for me, entrepreneurship was one of this, you know, paths which I could take. So that's kind of how I was thinking about this opportunity as well. And the price I'm paying to be here. And I'm not here because I want to, you know, live a comfortable life. I can live a very comfortable life back in Kyrgyzstan. But I want to actually challenge myself, grow personally and professionally, meet amazing people and, you know, and build a great company. So.
Yeah, that's awesome. Is there an obstacle in particular that motivation has helped you overcome?
Yeah, I mean, this is, I think, the superpower I have, which is like, I can take any risk, right? My risk tolerance is pretty high because also like knowing where I come from, I'm like, yeah, you know, like everything is an upside here. So if you told Chinggis when I was 18 years old, who didn't speak any English, like Chinggis, you will be in Silicon Valley when you'll be like 30 something and you'll be building a tech company. You'll raise a bunch of money. You'll hire really smart people to build a company with you. Like back then, I mean, I couldn't imagine that that was possible, right? And here I am. And I think that gives me the perspective. I think most people probably like, you know, don't have, which is, I mean, in the US, maybe not everyone, but in the US, which is, I think that's a baseline, right? That's where I come from. And for me, I'm already like kind of living the dream of Chinggis, which was 18 years old. So that's the perspective and being super grateful, but also like, you know, everything is already, I'm already like on the upside. I just need to like keep pushing. So
That sounds like a very powerful motivation.
Thanks.
And you mentioned that you have a technical co-founder,
yeah,
but you founded an AI company. So What's it been like for you as the non-technical person, but driving an AI company?
Yeah. Really good question. I think I'm not technical, but I'm such a curious person. You know, like the one characteristic which we had this exercise with my wife, which was like, I think someone asked us, it was like a group of friends and we were like asking like, if you wrote a book, or if there was a book about you, how you would name it? And my wife immediately said, Unstoppable. And she's unstoppable. She's also an entrepreneur. Probably you need to also invite her to your podcast. Yes. She's a founder of company Alma. It's AI company helping immigration, helping immigration make it easier.
Awesome.
And I was thinking about it, like, you know, like how I would name my book. And my book would be driven by curiosity. Because every single thing was like, you know, I was able to achieve or I was able to learn because I was just curious. Oh, what is this? Why is this way? You know? And so I feel this characteristic of mine, I think, is helping me a lot, you know, being a non-technical founder in an AI startup. And I feel like, and I learn a lot, you know, from my co-founder, who's like very technical. He's very deep into AI and ML. So, but at the same time, I feel like, you know, the AI is moving so fast and it's every week, I think it hasn't been a week where something new didn't come up, you know, every week something new. And you just need to be adaptable. You need to be resilient. You just need to learn fast. I think that's kind of the attitude I have. And I think being like non-technical even gives me I'm so naive maybe sometimes, which might be even a good thing, you know, that I'm like, I can assume certain things and then I can ask, hey, is this possible? I think this should be possible. And technical people, like, first they're like, this is not possible. But then they come back in a couple of days, like, Chingiz, you cannot believe, but this was possible. Because AI is changing so many things, you know. A couple of days ago, I was just having a coffee chat with one of our engineers. And he's a very strong engineer. And he was so impressed by recent Claude, you know, by Anthropic's code assistant. He was basically like, you don't believe it, but I gave a task. I went to grab a coffee. I came back. The code was complete. There was like very small tweaks I made and things were like working perfectly.
Wow.
Well, and you know, like these are the things, right? And I think if you're an expert, like you're really an expert, I think, of course, you know so much, but the downside is that you assume certain things which maybe are not true now because of the changes which happened like yesterday. So I feel like this expertise comes with a price and naivete comes with this benefit of, I don't know anything. So, you know, it's just like, I don't know, maybe this should work. This should work. And having this assumption, I think having this, I guess like this, I would say it's even a plus, you know, sometimes, but at the same time, you know, you need to be like relentlessly learning about the new ways of solving problems. And AI is a solution, you know. I feel like what we are doing here at Codiv is like we're solving problems. And understanding the customer's problem, I think, is more important than, you know, than knowing, oh, specific thing AI can do or cannot do.
Yeah.
But really understanding like your user's problem, I think. That's basically, I think, my main job actually here.
I like that. And it ties back into what you mentioned. Your pitch to your co-founder was, hey, I think there's a lot of problems that we could solve for a bunch of businesses. So how did you even arrive at that pitch and how did that work out?
Yeah, in hindsight, I remember when I heard his pitch about what he built at Uber, I was like, interesting. I never heard, you know, such a platform and the impact it made. I'm like, and Uber is one of the most innovative companies, you know, of our generation. If Uber did this year ago or like half a year ago, I'm sure there's so many companies who have never even thought about this. So, and one of the biggest, I think, insights I think Norm had when he was building this tool at Uber is that because they built this a few automations, like engineering team, the core engineering team in the Bay Area. And Uber is a multi-global, it's a global company, you know, like they have multi like regions, like global meta regions, like India, you know, Europe, like US. And so they quickly realized that they cannot scale automations beyond what they built. So they had to go beyond building this. They had to reimagine building these automations, the process of building automations. And they built this maybe 5-6 automations, which was automating maybe 10%, but they quickly realized that customer support experience in different countries is very different. Like refund experience in Argentina is very different from refund experience in India because the payment methods are different. They're like the experience is different. So expectations are different. So then they had to kind of rethink their approach. And what they did was like, what if we enable non-technical business teams on the ground to design and build this end-to-end automations themselves, because they're the experts of the business. They're closer to the user. What if we build a tool for them so they can understand, they can build, and they can iterate, and they can test. And that's what led them to from like 10% to like 80% automation, like in a year or two, because they enabled non-technical business teams to build this thing. So when I heard this pitch, I was like, this is awesome. And we started doing this from Stanford. You know, one lesson I learned was talk to users, right? Talk to people, learn about if it's a problem or not. They didn't have the same problem. If you know, you ask, oh, are you trying to scale your automations? No one would say yes. So you had to ask the right questions. So at some point we found that a lot of brands in the US, mid-market brands, support teams, they don't get enough engineering resources. Support teams, they are, you know, it's perceived by the company as a cost center. And that's why you don't get enough engineering resources, because engineering resources are spent on revenue generating projects and core product stuff or marketing. And then we were like, huh, this was the insight where we were like, what if we enable non-technical business teams in customer support teams to build and manage these automations, just like we did at Uber? That was basically the aha moment for us. We're like, there is a need for sure. Business teams on support team, they really want to build these things, but they don't have engineering resources and they don't have a platform which can they can use to build this end to end. So that was basically a kind of aha moment for us to say, there's something here.
And you mentioned something that is super important, but super tricky, which is asking the right questions.
Definitely.
How did you figure that out? Because nobody's going to say, oh, I need more engineering resources. Can you solve that for me?
Yeah. You know, like, I think I like this Henry Ford's quote, right? Which is, if you ask people around what they need, they would have told me, like, I need a faster horse, right? So that would, exactly. So what I think philosophy we have is like, customers are experts of the problem and we're the experts of the solution. So we never ask, oh, what do you think we should build? No. The question is, can you tell me, like open-ended questions, can you tell me how you do things, you know? And we're like, oh, can you tell me more about why do you do these things in this way? And how much time do you spend? So like, and I think the curiosity mindset helps so much. And, you know, and I recently heard this quote, I think it was like Lex Friedman's podcast, I think, but it was this difference between perception and perspective. And I think being able to switch whenever you're perceiving something from your perspective to the other person's perspective. And I think this ability to switch every single time, when you're selling, when you're like talking to clients, being able to see things from their perspective, try as much as you can. And I would recommend one book, it's called Mom Test. I don't know if you heard about this book, but I found one of the most helpful books when I was like talking to users, how to approach, you know, conversations, be open-minded, ask open-ended questions. And also what I found is like in the US, people are very nice, you know, like in Korea, some people are nice, but they're very direct. If they don't like something, they're like, geez, you're working on like bullshit idea. You know, people in Korea will tell me that.
And that's valuable.
That's super valuable, right? In the US, people are so nice. They would be sugarcoating. They would be like, this sounds great. And then like you follow up or you do something, they just don't respond, or like they're like, oh, by the way, this is cool, but yeah, we have other priorities, right? So yeah. I feel like being able to understand what they actually mean, not what they actually say, this is so important, especially in this journey from zero to one. So, and I think, you know, the Mom Test helped me. I think this curiosity, which is like, just, I want to understand from your perspective, you know, like, and then, for example, there was this conversation, I remember, when we was just getting started. I was like, and the person was like so excited. I was like, yeah, you know, it's such a big problem for me. I hate this, blah, blah, blah. And then I was like, okay, like, what are you not able to achieve? Or what's the implication of this pain point for you? And he says, yeah, I have this part-time person who's spending like 1 hour, like a month solving this problem for me. And I was like, okay, you're speaking so passionately about this problem, but the implication is just 1 hour part-time person, you know, and it is, you know, like this, sometimes like how you say it, it doesn't mean actually like what's the implication of this pain point. And if I like went and built something for this pain, I would have definitely wasted a few months of my time. So,
yeah. And I've heard the advice to try and figure out what people will pay for it. How has that worked out for you?
Yeah. So in my opinion, I know like, you know, it's not perfect, but what my perspective was like, you know, whenever you start talking to users in the very early days, especially B2B users. If you're building a B2B company, like what I was doing at the time, and then still, I started seeing, like, looking for signals before the money. You know, the money is the ultimate value. But I felt like, you know, there's some, like, other, like, leading indicators of value. For example, if the person keeps spending time with me, because these are busy people, time is definitely one of the values. Two is a reputation. Are they willing to introduce me to their network? Are they willing to introduce me to their boss or peer in the company? The boss is, like, higher regarded signal, because if they're introducing me to their boss, this is a real pain, and I think the boss really cares as well. So there's this, you know, some early, like, signals of something is moving in the right direction. So asking for time, more time, and asking for reputation, you know, like getting some introductions. And then it comes down to money, you know, so it's kind of like this ultimate value. So that's kind of how the framework I built for myself. Also, like, another kind of dimension of the same thing, which is more, okay, you know, we get to a point where, like, we build something, we would prioritize usage over revenue, or logos over revenue.
Mm.
So we would say, like, hey, we need feedback, right? And you need to pay something, but it's not about the money for now. You need to pay some money so that you have skin in the game, but it's not something that is prohibitive for you. Like, it doesn't require you to go and get a budget, you know, approval or something. And you would sometimes ask, you know, what would be the price you would be able to sign off yourself? And they would tell me, like, oh, 2K, I can do that. And we're like, okay, 2K it is, you know, and just, we would get this product into their hands. And then we would be, like, constantly, like, watching how they're using it, how they're, like, you know, actually, like, getting value out of it. And I would say, like, usage is over revenue in the first 6 or 9 months of your company. And I think always thinking about, like, some leading indicators of value, which is, in my opinion, it's, you know, time, reputation, and money, like, money being the ultimate, you know, ultimate signal of value.
Yeah, no, that's a really clear framework. I love it.
Yeah, thanks.
So how does Codif use AI?
Yeah, so we use AI in every piece of our product. So without AI, Codif would not exist. Basically, that's kind of the description. We have a system of AI agents. And when I say system of AI agents, we look at, like, customer support team from the composition of the team perspective. Typically, customer support team, every support team has a support agent who's actually working on cases, working on tickets. Then we have support manager who's actually looking at all the tickets. They're, like, checking the quality, you know, if it's good or not. They're checking, like, if agents are following the policies, right? SOPs, you know, of the company. They're also generating new knowledge-based articles. They're also thinking about, like, how we can improve the processes, right? They're managing the team. And then we have directors who are actually looking at data, right? Okay, you know, how we can make it better, how we can improve the system, how we can get insights from support ticket data to educate the rest of the business on what's going on. For example, if the product launch went wrong, you know, the support tickets will tell you about it. And the way we think, you know, about our system of AI agents is in a similar fashion. We think there should be an AI agent who is kind of doing the work of support agent. We have AI manager who is actually doing the work of AI manager, like helping, you know, which is like generating new knowledge-based articles. We are always looking into, like, opportunities to improve processes, and AI can do that as well. And then, like, at the highest level, it's AI director, which is actually looking at all the tickets and actually getting insights, saying, hey, it looks like there's this, you know, spike in this ticket type, and signaling early on to the rest of the team, maybe to the rest of the company, if it was a market. Sometimes, you know, marketing campaign can go wrong. You get so many tickets, right? So having this quick feedback loop between support tickets and the rest of the business, that's also something that our AI director does. So in a nutshell, we were building a system of AI agents which can augment human agents, support managers, and then directors.
And that's a fascinating way to build the whole system, because it sounds like you're not just, I guess, replacing a help desk, but you're actually augmenting the whole support team.
Exactly.
How do you talk about that with customers? Could you describe it a bit more?
Yeah, we say this, right? So And I want to just share like also the context, right? Like on what was going on in the support space in the past, like maybe 30 years in software.
Sure, please.
So the fundamental idea of how work is done is changing. So the work, I think, in support world was all about human doing the real work, doing tickets. And the whole ecosystem of tools emerged as a result of this fundamental idea. And I'll give you examples. So ticketing platforms came up because help desk, right? Okay, we need to enable human to receive a ticket, read a ticket, understand what's going on, go resolve the problem and respond back, right? There are some, of course, it's more complex than that, but high level, that's what ticketing platforms do, enabling humans to resolve issues. Then workforce management tools came up and they were like, okay, we need to now schedule these human agents. We need to enable them to be scheduled across the time zones and shifts, depending on your seasonality, depending on the business of your support or operations. Then there's another tooling, which is QA software. Okay, now we need to check the quality of these human support agents, how they're responding to customers, right? Then there's knowledge management platforms, Guru, Asam, I think it was like Confluence, some others, where they're enabling humans to retrieve knowledge from systems and find the knowledge faster to respond to customers. So if you think about in a BPO industry, right? BPO industry is by itself is just providing this human workforce. And it was all around this idea that humans is the atomic unit of work. And then there are all these tools. And then now we're seeing this in real world is that AI agents can do this work for humans, which kind of raises this big question, what's going to happen, right? And no one knows what's going to happen, but I feel like that's the world we're living in. And Codiff is one of the companies which is, you know, inventing this kind of future. We're like building this future where agentic AI can do the work and also we can actually do insights from tickets. So that's kind of what's going on, I think, on the macro level. If we like zoom out, right? If we zoom in, the way we talk about our platform is we call this operating system for your CX team. We're building like AI CX team, AI teammates, AI CX teammates. So that's kind of our pitch. And when we explain, this makes sense. We're like, we know like workflows at each level of the organization. And of course, most of our attention goes to this agentic, you know, which is actually like resolving contextual, complicated action required tickets. We call them tier two tickets where, you know, it requires an action in multiple systems. Mm-hmm. So that's what actually Codiff does very well. And this is historically was done only by human agents.
Ooh. And you said a fascinating term there, which was the atomic unit of work.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like you're rethinking what support should look like as an AI first product. How has that evolved? How did you get to that?
Yeah, I think it's coming from the real world examples and the real work with our customers. So I think the future is going to be where like AI-led experience will be like the first default experience. And human experience will be a premium experience if something didn't go well, which will be less and less because AI will get better, AI will learn, and also we will build more AI agents for every single company, right? So there will be more cases covered by AI. So eventually, like today, if you think about, you know, you have millions of agents and like you have like maybe 90% is like human agents and 10% is AI, it's going to flip in the next 5 to 10 years. Maybe even faster than that. But I think this idea that AI is add-on right now, which still kind of, you know, exists, I think, it will be like completely flipped. It will be like human experience will be the add-on experience and it will be like completely like different like dynamics there. And we think a lot about this actually, right? We look at our customers, mm-hmm. how they're thinking about this. And of course, you know, the AI by itself, like without humans. And I think one like idea which kind of fascinates me is that, you know, for the first time almost in history of software, it's like AI is actually, or tools are going to do the work and humans will be enabling these tools to do the work. Because without humans training, without humans involvement into coaching this AI agent, it won't work. So, and if you think about the previous generation of software, it was always like, about software enabling humans to do their work, right? Ticketing platforms enabled humans to do their work. But still humans, they do the work. The ultimate like atomic unit of work is done by humans. Versus like now, like this relationship is like completely flipping, you know, from tools that enable humans to do the work to humans enabling AI or tools to do the work. And it's a fascinating switch because it means, you know, it means so many different things. And the way you build software, like for the world where you're enabling tool to the human to do the work, it's different. You're thinking about like usability because you're thinking about the how humans work, right? Whenever you're building that first type of software, you're thinking, oh, like it has to be nicely designed point and click interface, right? But when you're thinking about when humans are switching and becoming enablers of tools, you're completely thinking about different things. You're thinking about explainability. You're thinking about transparency, how you can actually build a system which is so explainable so that humans can go and understand what's going on, like immediately they can unblock or they can debug the AI agent quickly. And I feel, you know, this flip is actually something we're like witnessing in real time right now.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever heard anyone model it that way before, as humans enabling tools. That's really exciting. And what is the work that a human does with Codiv?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of stuff, right? First, you need to build your AI agent. And you can do this like either you can write your AI agent, it's all in natural language, or you need to import your SOP, which already exists somewhere, because you give instructions to human agents, right? But then we built a framework, for example, because we know that AI agents, they don't think in the same way as humans do. So we built a framework where you give instructions to AI agent in the natural language in a way that AI will understand and will be so accurate in following it. So that's the first aspect of your work. You built an AI agent. Okay, cool. Now you need to test this AI agent against real case scenarios. And here you can either imitate a conversation yourself. We built a testing framework and you can actually imitate the conversation. You can test so many edge cases. What will happen if the question will be this and that and this? And then that's kind of the second piece, but also you can actually upload your historical conversations and you can just run them through how this new AI agents would have handled this conversations from the past. And then you test this, you get to a good level of accuracy. And then your goal is to release this into production gradually so that you can always monitor what's going on. And then you can always tweak something, you can go back and retest it. So it's kind of like constant iteration. What's nice about this, you invest a lot of time upfront and these AI agents will be up and running. It's not like with humans, like humans churn, they like, you know, the attrition rate is high for support agents. But with our AI agents, you know, like, yes, we never say like it's plug and play. AI agents, I think they're going to be unique to your company. They need to be trained on your brand's voice. We need to know how you want to sound like to your customers. You might be very informal. You maybe make your AI agents use certain terms. For example, we have this use case, for example, is called disambiguation. Some companies have one word which might mean three things. Credit means credit score, credit check, or credit history. And you want to tell your AI agent, because humans would go and clarify, like, hey, what do you mean? AI agent needs to get some instructions as well. So that's what humans do with our AI. But once it's done, you need to constantly like look at conversations. We have a QA framework as well. But high level, like that's what you do. And then you get to a very comfortable place with your AI program.
How do you think that intersects with the jobs that will be available to humans in the future?
So the way we think is the CX jobs will be elevated and some of them will be eliminated. I mean, I'm not going to be like sugarcoating here, but I think the quality of work will be so much higher, you know, in terms of, and the way I was thinking about this is even internally, is like, there'll be like CX engineers, which is like, you can build your AI agent without being technical, by the way. And that's I think that's the advantage of me not being technical, because I'm like, if I don't understand this, I don't think any non-technical person will understand this. So that's kind of like a positive thing of me not being technical. But the idea is this, right? And also there's this thing called Jevons paradox. And basically the idea is that if something becomes very available, people say, oh, like the usage is going to go down. Usually it's the opposite. It's a paradox that actually it becomes more popular. The example of this is like ATMs, right? When ATMs came up in 1920s in the US, everyone thought, oh, bank tellers' job will be gone. There won't be bank tellers ever. And now there are more bank tellers by 100x or 1000x than it was in 1920s, because the banking became so available, you know, the resource became so available. So, and I think with support, I feel like, you know, customer support is probably underserved still. So there's an argument to be made that probably because of this, a lot of these tickets will be handled by AI agents, simple ones, and more complicated ones, which customers would never reach out to client companies because they're like, ah, this is pain. I don't want to do that. Now they'll be more willing to go and talk to AI agent. If not, then to human agent. So there's an argument to be made that probably like you won't be like as bad as we all are thinking. At the same time, I'm not saying like this won't impact any jobs. It will. And in some ways, it will be like elevating jobs from doing the work to actually teaching AI to do the work. I think that's kind of the big transition from the work perspective. And from other like angles, I would say like it's, and I heard this somewhere, I don't remember where, but it's not going to be like AI versus human. It's going to be human with AI against human. So, and you want to be on the same side with AI. You want to be enabled by AI if you're doing the work, because some work will still be done by humans. If you're like a high level director or VP, probably your work is more about judgment, you know, like judgment calls or decisions, conversations with customers or employees. And if you're using AI like to do that, to do your work, it's, I think that's where you want to be. And yeah, if AI is replacing your job, then you probably want to be like, you know, how I can become a teacher or coach or, you know, a trainer of AI, because this is going to be like a job on its own. And we even started seeing this from our clients that they started having this position title, AI manager of AI tools. And these are the people who will be like managing the whole AI program for CX, for sales, for different organizations. So, and you need to, you don't need to be technical to do that. So that's kind of the nice thing about tools of this generation, including Codiv.
Very neat. Manager of AI tools. I'm excited to see job postings for that.
Oh man, I saw a couple of job postings and we were even helping to draft some of those for our clients.
That's super cool. Any chance you could share one with me so I could just share what it looks like? Because I've never seen one.
Like, I'll share, like, I anonymize it and I'll share one with you.
Sure. Yeah, that'd be amazing. Thank you.
Yeah, 100%.
And what's a deeply held belief that you've had about AI that's changed?
That's a good question. We had this conversation like a couple of days ago where one of our engineers like, hey, you know, like we're doing this thing to like support agents, but Anthropic or Cursor, you know, these companies like which are like building this AI engineers, they're like replacing us, you know? And so it's kind of like crazy world, right? But in my opinion, I think, but, and I always thought, yeah, you know, this is probably like coming very soon, but this is probably a hot take, but I don't think AGI will be something that will replace all this human work. And I used to think like a couple of years ago, well, a year and a half ago, I'm like, whoa, this AI would probably completely like wipe us out and it will be like so much smarter. And of course, you know, we're working with AI and stuff like that, but even like at the enterprise level, we're seeing a lot of imperfections. You need to build a lot of guardrails, frameworks. So working like very closely with AI, I cannot see where AGI is in like in 2 years or 3 years, and which I kind of used to believe. And so I wouldn't say like, I don't think AGI, I mean, I'm hearing Sam Altman and like Dario from Anthropic, like they're all talking about AI replacing everything and AGI is coming. And I, yeah, I'm not technical, of course, but you know, I'm like working like with customers' problems every day and I'm using this cutting edge tools for this, like LLMs. And I'm still seeing so many things that can be done better, you know? And I'm like, and that's the kind of dissonance I have, which is, yeah, I trust what these guys are telling me, but at the same time, on the ground, I'm not seeing that. And there's this big gap yet still. So, and I feel like that's what I used to believe, but when I started really like working closer and solving real problems in customer support, I'm not saying customer support is the most complicated. It's like actually maybe one of the most obvious applications of Gen AI, but imagine if you're talking about healthcare, right? Or, you know, you're talking about AI doctors or AI lawyers, regulated industries. I think there's a long way to go, actually.
I like it. I also find some of those claims hard to believe.
Yeah.
And just as the last question, is there anything that you would like to share or to talk about that we haven't yet?
I just want to maybe share this thought, which is humans were so resilient, you know, in history of humankind. Is just we've come so far. And, you know, this electricity example, when electricity came out, like, no one thought that, you know, television will be there and then television will be enabled by electricity. That's why, like, TV shows will come up and there will be so many people employed in these jobs someone wouldn't have imagined, you know, in 1920s. Or another example, like fridge, like freezing technology, which came up, which is, you know, also enabled by electricity. And then, like, companies like Coca-Cola came up and became one of the main beneficiaries of freezing technology, like the fridge companies, right? So, you know, humans are so resilient, and I'm sure, like, you know, humans, we will find out what to do next. And even if low-paying jobs and boring jobs will be gone, we'll definitely find something that is more meaningful and more important than maybe, like, my current job, which I'm so scared to lose. So I'm a techno-optimist, and I just want to share, like, that, hey, let's stay optimistic. We're resilient. We're stronger than we think we are. And we've come so far as a humanity. I just feel I'm so optimistic that we will figure it out.
I started this podcast because I wanted to stand at the gate of businesses using AI and see what separated hype from lasting impact. Back when cities had walls, you had to go into the city to do business at the market. So, if you wanted to talk to someone, you waited by the gate until they came in or came out. Do that enough times and you could talk to everyone. That's what I want to do, stand at the gate of people doing business with AI and talk to them, see what they do and why they do it. If you know someone that's making an impact in the world of AI, would you connect them with me? You can find me on LinkedIn or shoot me an email at daniel@maneri.house. That's daniel@manary.house. Thanks for listening.